Blog Talk Radio.
GoDamnMedia.com.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Red Fox Blogger with your host here, good old Cal Fritzy. We got a few things to get through today, but first and foremost, I am proud to tell you that I have a guest coming on at the top of the second portion of the program, and his name is Mike Holt, and he hails all the way from Australia. He is the CEO of Restore Australia, and that is the official website for the Foundation for a National Renewal. This website was created to return power to the people who must have a voice in the direction that their great nation takes. And he is also a highly successful man who engaged in a campaign to bring awareness of Islamic issues that affect her in Australia. You will be familiar with the sticker campaign. Remember those stickers, Beware Halal Food, the red ones? That was his campaign. You can actually buy those online now, and you know what? I have the link there that is restoreaustralia.org right there in my show highlights. So for those of you listening in archive, you can also link into there too as well. And you can get some really cool anti-jihad swag, as it were. So just to let you know, Mike Holt will be joining me later on in the program. But I want to talk to you about something right now before Mike gets here. I was reading my newspapers this morning, right? As I usually do, I go to the National Post, which, by the way, has still banned me from commenting. I sent another email to the letter to the editor, and I said to him, look, what is going on? Why is it that I'm still not allowed to post? So I told him that if this situation was not rectified, I was going to put his email link into my show notes by Friday and inundate, have my listeners inundate his inbox. So we'll have to wait and see what happens. But anyway, yes, in the morning, get my tea, open up my dailies, go to the National Post, go to the Toronto Sun, go to the Daily Mail. Well, I was at the National Post this morning and I came across this story and I was like, what is this? Muslim man charged in child sex trafficking in Canada. In Canada, yes. We are all familiar with the sex grooming gangs in Europe, in England in particular. We're familiar as to what is going on over there. I was reading this and I was thinking, wow, this is in Canada. The tentacles of Islam and their subjugation of women reach far and wide. In this particular case, his name is Reza Moazami. I'm reading the article. I wasn't too familiar with what the surname might have meant, but I had a funny feeling that it had to be a Muslim. So I read the article, and I will relate some of that to you in a minute. But I'm reading this article, and what set off alarm bells to me is that they were trying to protect his ethnicity as much as possible, is that this particular mainstream media article was very adamant in explaining that he was a Canadian citizen. Another thing that got my alarm bells going, the comment section was closed. So I decided to do a little bit of snooping to see who exactly this person was. And sure enough, I got to Atlas Shrugs, and Pamela Geller had the scoop there. I put the link in my blog. So my blog is also in the show notes. It should be at the very top of the page if you want to go in and take a look for it and read it for yourself. So anyway, yes, in Vancouver, Canada, there was a child sex trafficking ring going on, and Muslims were in charge of it. What was happening in Vancouver is that they were renting these apartment buildings, apartments in these buildings, I guess. And the buildings, they look pretty nice. They look respectable. But they were renting these apartments within this complex. And this is where they were bringing these girls. At the time, the ages ranged from 13 to 19, and they were kept inside these rented units, and they were made to work as prostitutes. This went on for 2 years. Now, the one person who is alleged, because he's not been found guilty yet, but we know he will be, so right now we have to use the word alleged. The one man who is alleged to have assembled and controlled this ring of threatened, assaulted, and exploited females, his name is Reza Moazami. Right now, he is accused of 36 crimes in all. That includes 2 counts of trafficking in persons under the age of 18, 6 counts of sexual assault, 7 counts of procuring a person to become a prostitute, and 9 counts of compelling and using threats to live on the avails of prostitution. Now, his trial finally began last week in British Columbia, and it is expected to last for several months. But this is now just hitting court. Yeah. This had been going on for a couple of years. They were 11 up to 19 at the time. They are now ranged in ages between 17 and 22, they will start taking the stand. Hopefully, as of today, the first of the 11 complainants has already. At the time of taping this show, I have not been back to see if there's an update. But how old is this guy? What is he? I think he's 29 or 39 or something. I don't know. It's in here somewhere in the article. But once again, sex grooming gangs, guys. We are so familiar with these going on. We hear about them all the time out of England. So when I was reading this in my newspaper, that this was occurring in Canada, I thought, oh, here we are. Islam, the global threat in North America. Now, I do not know about the United States, if there have been any notable cases of sex grooming gangs in the United States, but I imagine there has been. However, this is a first for Canada, that we would have Muslims engaging in this activity, taking our Indigenous Canadians and forcing them to work as prostitutes, certainly as young as the age of 11, is shocking. So I decided to do a little, like I say, I wanted to find out, is he a Muslim? And the mainstream media, the National Post, you know, they're covering it up. When I went to Atlas Shrugged, yep, she had all the stuff there. Had the goods on this guy, but I still wanted to know exactly what does his name mean, Moazami. So I was trying to do a surname search. I didn't come up too successful, but the closest I can come is that the surname is Middle Asian origin, probably Pakistan. Now we know in England, Pakistani Muslims are notorious for the sex grooming gangs over there. So to find out that the closest I could come to his surname would bring me to Pakistan is not shocking at all. He's a Canadian citizen. That means nothing. Pardon me. I cleared my throat, and I think you heard that. Anyway, he's a Canadian citizen, but that does not mean that he was born here. When he came over, I don't know if he came over here or what, but it just says he's a Canadian citizen, so he's probably a naturalized Canadian as opposed to being born here, which means he probably came from Pakistan or something like that. Who knows? But this guy was a real piece of work. He would use a number of methods to enlist the girls. He would approach some of them in public places, and they would be shown into his various apartments around town. And he would offer them what seemed at first, of course, to be a life of luxury. And, yes, drug use was encouraged, yes. Ply them with the nice things, get them drugs. Yeah, we've heard it all before from England, yeah. Same scenario right here in Canada. And they even gave them little pets. They gave them little lap dogs to play with. And, of course, they'd come attached to the animals. I mean, who wouldn't? You got yourself a cute little lap dog, and who doesn't like a little pet, right? Well, if they failed to behave, he would threaten to kill the pets, yeah. He would threaten to break the necks of their little pets. So they would comply with what Moazami wanted them to do, and, of course, that was he was tricking them out. Some of them were forced to work within the city. Some were sent as far away as other provinces to work. This is just absolutely disgusting. This is a grown man preying on our little girls doing this. I find this absolutely appalling. I have a clip I'm going to share with you in a moment. But just to give you an idea of what this guy is all about. Oh, yes, and he's 29, yes. He's 29 years old, and he's short and stocky with a muscular build. There we go. And but he would bully these little girls. And I'm saying little girls because, come on, remember, one is as young as 11 years old when she was procured into prostitution by this Coranimal. This guy was already known to the police when the Royal Canadian Mounted Police received a complaint, and that was in August of 2010. Now, according to Mike Corcoris, there was an anonymous tipster who claimed that the women, including a minor, were being used as prostitutes inside a North Vancouver condominium building and that aggressive males were involved. So Captain Corcoris, he testified, he went to the unit in question and he was met at the door by an inebriated man who said he had some friends inside, quote unquote, okay, had some friends inside. But he entered the apartment. He saw two young females in the living room. He said that both were dressed in a provocative manner, in short shorts. One of the girls was just 15. There was visible drug paraphernalia scattered about, and that included a device commonly used to smoke crack cocaine. One of the girls, he said, was clutching a small dog. Now, Corcoris, he looked around the rest of the apartment. And in the kitchen, he opened a pantry door, and he discovered a second adult male hiding inside, and that was Mr. Moazami. The Mountie said that he recognized him from previous dealings and asked him why was he hiding. And he said, well, the police make me nervous. Yeah, I bet, buddy. You've been busted big time. Like I say, he was known to the RCMP. He had been arrested for matters unrelated to the charges he's facing right now. So they knew who this guy was. This guy was running around. Guy already had charges against him, and now he's brazen enough to engage in sex grooming gangs. My goodness. This was in 2011, remember. Now, 7 months later, the police were called to a condominium tower in downtown Vancouver. Now, the building's caretaker, and he's also a building resident, him and another building resident, they both called police about a possible assault in progress involving a man and a woman. So the Vancouver police, they show up again, and they were led to an eighth-floor suite, whereas the Mountie, he encountered a distraught woman. Now, initially, she gave police a false name, but she is currently now one of the 11 complainants. That's another thing. Pay attention to that. She initially gave the police a false name because she was terrified, because this character was threatening her. And threatening her little dog, too, for crying out loud. Okay, so here we go. There's another police officer who encountered our lovely Moazami in the building lobby. He was sweaty, nervous, and he had scratches on his neck. He said that he had just had rough sex. God. Guys, he was released again. But in October of 2011, police discovered him hiding in a Vancouver body house. And this time, he was hiding behind a hot water tank. So after that, prostitution and human trafficking charges followed. Our little friend, Moazami, he's breached his bail conditions the following year while trying to contact one of his alleged victims. Well, he's been in custody ever since. So now we have this trial going on. There are 11 complainants expected to testify. Hopefully, as of today, one has already taken the stand. But this is the sex grooming gang phenomena, rampant in England, coming to a shore near you. Needless to say, this is not what I expected to talk about today at all. But this was one I could not let slip by my listeners. You have to be aware of what is going on. Muslims in North America, after your daughters, to pass them around, ply them with drugs, like they're garbage. Anyway, I have a little bit of history about sex grooming gangs. I'm going to share that with you in a moment. But I did want you to play this. I wanted to play this audio for you. This is from RT News in the UK. And Polly Boyko is interviewing Sean Thomas on the phenomena of sex grooming gangs. So just take a listen. I'm going to tee it up for you.
To the UK now, where one of the alleged machete killers who hacked a British soldier to death on a London street has been officially charged with murder. Michael Adebayo is currently in court. The gruesome killing has added to the anti-Muslim and anti-immigrant sentiments in the country. And authorities are now increasingly under fire for downplaying the race and religion factor in crimes. The notorious Oxford sex grooming ring case being one of the most recent examples. RT's Polly Boyko explains.
Across the country, many have been shocked at the uncovered sexual exploitation rings, first in Rochdale, then Rotherham, Derby, and most recently in Oxford. Gangs of men lure vulnerable young girls, some as young as 10, with presents in order to gain their trust. Then they force them to take drugs, rape them, and finally they sell them off into prostitution. The reported gangs are made up of Muslim men, their victims, young white girls. So is the government choosing to ignore obvious markers when it comes to these horrific crimes, race and religion? To talk about the issue, I'm joined by Sean Thomas. He's a writer and journalist. Sean, you've written about the case in Oxford. Is there an elephant in the room? Is the government choosing to shy away from making a connection between these men's religion and their white victims?
I think unquestionably yes in the past. There is some evidence that these crimes have been going on since the early 1990s, if not before. Additionally, a Labour MP, Anne Cryer, raised the issue maybe 10 or 15 years ago, and of course, notoriously, the head of the British National Party, a far-right politician, raised it in 2001 and in 2004. And when it was raised in 2004, it was the subject of a secret BBC documentary, and the reaction of the political and legal establishment to Nick Griffin, that far-right politician, raising the issue, was to try and silence him, not to investigate the crimes. He obviously is regarded as being an ethnocentric, if not racist, politician. But they ignored everything he said and instead tried to silence his point of view. And so the crimes went on for another 5 or 6 years at least before they became finally revealed in the last 2 to 3 years.
You've also mentioned in your writing that it was a Muslim prosecutor driving the sentencing in the Oxford case. Do you think anybody who was non-Muslim feared being branded a racist if they looked too closely at the case?
The fact that it took a Muslim prosecutor in the northwest of England to finally cut through them and say, yes, there is a problem here, shows that white prosecutors, white social workers, white legal officers, and white politicians were very wary of addressing the issue because they are all terrified of being associated with the BNP, with the far right, of being seen as racist. It can ruin careers if you get that label.
And yet the government hasn't taken this up as an issue. Do you think it's too dangerous a can of worms to open?
Yes, completely. And in fact, to be fair to the government and the police forces, they are now in fact tackling this crime pretty damn seriously. I was reading a report the other day which said there are now 54 ongoing investigations into separate Asian grooming gangs around the UK. But in itself, that is an astonishing figure. That's 54 gangs. And each of these gangs may have dozens or even hundreds of victims. So we are talking about possibly thousands and thousands of girls who've been abused, raped, and some even probably murdered in the last 20 years because this crime was ignored. I mean, it is very shocking. We have to accept that, yes, white people can also be victims of racial crimes, and I'd say these girls were such victims.
Sean Thomas, many thanks for your comments. There you have it. The Muslim Council of Britain is going to dedicate their next meeting to talking about how they can stamp out such cases of abuse, but we're yet to hear anything from the government on the issue. Polly Boyko, RT, London.
And that tape was from about 4 months ago, so it's fairly fresh. But you can see, you're listening to that tape, right? And you're listening to what Sean Thomas is saying about Anne Cryer and Nick Griffin, these MPs that were bringing it up as far back as 2001, and then they brought it back up again in 2004, and it was not pursued, not seriously, anyway. And, of course, listening to that tape, you heard Mr. Thomas refer to them perhaps being bigots and racist and Islamophobes. That's right, we've got grown men. We've got grown Muslims running around raping 11-year-old little girls, but if you try to say anything about it, you're an Islamophobe? Come on! Knock it off. Nick Griffin, he's apparently a far-right politician. And you know us conservatives. Yeah, we're all racist. Jeez. 2001, that went back. here in Canada, that case I just cited. That was going back a number of years as well. The youngest victim at the time, 11 years old, is now 17. Since when does it become racist to discuss the issues of Islam and the atrocities behind this so-called religion? Since when? I'm getting very, very, very sick and tired of all of this. I'm getting sick and tired of the political correctness, and I'm certainly sick and tired of the, protected status that Muslims seem to enjoy. I do not understand for the life of me why we go out of our way to protect them. They do not deserve it. They come here to create havoc, they come here to create problems, and they come here to make demands, and they come here to change. I was listening to a program, I was listening to the Lowell Green Show out of Ottawa the other day, and he brought up a really good topic, and of course that generated the phone lines to just go crazy because that's an open topic, open talk radio show as well, you can call in. So he said, he premised the question, is it time to rethink Islamic immigration into Canada? And of course that's a question being asked all over the Western globe. That's a big one in the United States. That's a big one in Europe. Of course, he was discussing Canada. I would say about 90% of the callers said yes. Now, Lowell Green, he's also very much a conservative like yours truly here. And he got the odd call from the odd Muslim. Why are you discussing this? Why aren't you talking about what NATO is doing in over, you know, killing our... Just the usual garbage, all right? So this guy, he gets on the airwaves, and he's talking with Lowell and telling Lowell to shut up. He doesn't understand. And Lowell kept him on the line for a very long time and was quizzing him and was asking him, well, in the Quran, how come you're not allowed to make friends with me? Oh, that's not true. That's not true. Well, yeah, it's right in the Quran. You're not allowed to make friends with an infidel. Oh, you're reading it wrong. You're reading the wrong Quran. Yeah, that's what he said. If you can believe this, he actually said on the airwaves, you must be reading the wrong Quran. I think Lowell Green had to mute himself because he spat out his coffee or something. But really, you're reading the wrong Quran. Okay, I got you now.
Yeah.
But he went on. He was digging himself deeper and deeper and deeper. And Lowell was saying, you know, well, you know, why is it that you are compelled to kill infidels? Oh, that's not in the Quran. We're not supposed to kill anybody. And you know the famous passage. And he quoted it. To kill one human being is to kill mankind. Well, of course, he did not go into the rest of that hadith, didn't he? No, he did not. He did not expand on it. He did not quote, I think it's 5.33, I can't remember, I don't have it in front of me. But the whole, entire citation of that particular hadith is, yeah, to kill one human being is to kill all of mankind, but to kill the unbeliever is to save all mankind. Along that line, you guys get my gist, okay? What essentially the Quran says, do not kill Muslims. Don't kill the fellow Muslims. Nope, nope. But you can kill the infidel. You can kill the kafir. You can kill the unbeliever. You can kill the Jew hiding behind that tree. So this guy was trying to really snowball the listeners, but he was not getting a pass because we're too smart. We're too smart to put up with what they think they can get away with anymore. And this is one more example, sex grooming gangs. And to report on them because we're racist? Please. But that is a good question. When you hear about this sort of thing approaching North America, what does that make you think? Do you think it is time to have a serious discussion about Islamic immigration? Do you think it's time for us to place a moratorium on Islamic immigration? What about instead of importing all of these bloody Somalis like President Hussein Obama wants to do, that we start bringing in the persecuted Christians in Islamic states? What about those Christians in Pakistan? What happened there on the weekend? Their church burnt down. All those people murdered. What about those in Kenya? What about those in Syria? What about those in Iran? What about those in Saudi Arabia, where you can face a jail sentence or even death for even so much as is procuring a Bible? What about those? How come we don't encourage that sort of immigration? I mean, I would gladly, my tax dollars would gladly go towards to help a Christian family resettle in my country. Gladly. A lot of people question, well, why do the Islamists come over here anyway? Well, they hate us. We're infidels. They hate our man-made laws. They hate our constitutions. They hate our women. They obviously hate our little girls. So why do they come over? Because we make it that easy for them. We, in the West, we're very generous people. Unfortunately, we're very generous with our welfare systems as well. We're very generous about freedom of religion. And that is something else, perhaps, that we should be addressing. Freedom of religion means that you can go to your church or your synagogue or your mosque and you can pray freely without any sort of persecution for doing so. Freedom of religion doesn't mean that you throw it in my face and you tell me that you can do things because it is within your religion to do so. And that does not mean walking around in a tent, tossing your beliefs in my face, on my public square. That is not what freedom of religion is supposed to mean. It means that you can freely practice your religion within your institution, your faith institution. So I want to get back. I went off on a tangent, but that's all right. I needed to. Yeah, like I say, though, I was reading these stories. I went to Atlas Shrugs. I went to the National Post. I find out that there's a sex grooming gang, Islamic sex grooming gang, going on here, right here in Canada. So I thought, okay, I got to address this, you know. There are so many cases. The most ones that I'm familiar with, like I say, come out of England. But what are sex grooming gangs, and what is it with men of Pakistani origin in particular that seem to favor targeting our young children? There's a couple of case studies here. There's one that involved one person, well, he's a Quranimal, named Razwan Razik and his 24-year-old brother Umar. Also involved here was Mohammed Safran, Ramzan, Abdil Hussein, Moshin Khan. These guys ranged in ages between 30 and 21. Notorious sex grooming case out of Sheffield, England. Okay? What do they do and why? They do it because, first of all, they can. Because we let them get away with it. In a lot of cases, we balk at persecuting them because, like Sean Thomas mentioned, when people like Anne Cryer and Nick Griffin try to bring it to the attention, they're backed off. And they're more or less compartmentalized as nothing more than cranks and racist and Islamophobes. And a lot of people don't understand, though, what this does to the children. I mean, for goodness sake. And the children that they prey on. Not all of the children come from broken homes or foster care. No. A lot of kids, they come from all walks of life. It doesn't matter the background of the child. What matters is what faces the child in the future and what the ramifications behind being a victim of a sex grooming gang means to that of a young woman and how it affects her when she grows up. What kind of baggage do they carry? How much damage, psychological and physical damage that they do. We've heard of cases where young girls have been rendered infertile because of the brutality of the rapes of grown men. Here's one for you. There is a little girl named Sophie. Her mom, Jane, described Sophie as a very happy, ordinary 12-year-old, until she met a group of adult males who would control every aspect of her life. You know, before she escaped, a year later, Sophie had been raped by the gang members as a way of breaking her in, and then she was passed around to various other men for sex. Now, the methods used by the pimps are sophisticated and they're sinister. Now, first, the girls are identified in locations such as parks, schools, leisure facilities, and shopping malls, after which boys of their age are sent to befriend them. After a friendship is established, the boys introduce their contacts to young men, whom they often describe as cousins. Mm-hmm. That's what they do. They initially approach them in public places, and they befriend a boy, you know, around the same age, and the boy's introducing them to their cousins. Well, just gets better and better. The grooming process really gets underway then, because the young man will take the girl out to his car. He'll give her vodka, cigarettes, marijuana, and take her to venues she would not normally experience until older. He often gives her a mobile phone or a cell phone as a gift. This way the pimp is able to track her every move by calls and texting, which eventually will be used by him to send instructions as to details of arrangements with punters. The men sell the girls on the contacts for around maybe $300 at a time, maybe $300 US. This is nothing more than a business deal now. Initially, these girls, they grow attached to their usually handsome suitors. And they grow attached to things like little lap dogs. What did Sophie have to say? I was always asked why I kept going back to my pimp, but they flatter you and make you think you are really loved. I thought he was my boyfriend until it was too late to get away. Another tactic that these pimps use is getting the girls to despise and mistrust her own parents in order that he can achieve total control over her. The pimps routinely tell their victims that their parents are racist towards Asian people. And, of course, this is a term used in Europe. And their parents are racist towards Muslim people. And that they disapprove of their relationships because the men are of Pakistani Muslim heritage, not because they are older. If my 11-year-old came home with a 20-year-old boyfriend... yikes. Some of the parents I met were racist, and some had developed almost a phobia against Muslim men. They were fueled by the misinformation and bigotry trotted out by racist groups in response to the pimping gangs. For God's sake. Mm-hmm. And that's what they were doing in Vancouver. Grooming these girls and brainwashing them. There is a lot of reluctance of the various anti-child abuse campaigns and charities to engage openly with the fact that the majority of men involved in child grooming criminal gangs are Pakistani Muslim, because that would connotate that the organization is racist. Mm-hmm. The fact that these particular gangs are made up of Pakistani men is significant, but not in the way racists would have us believe. This is one child protection expert. She asked not to be named. While the British National Party would have us believe that abusing white girls is an endemic part of these men's culture, which is absolutely is not, excuse me, sorry about that, The truth is that these men are aware that the police do not want to be accused of racism in today's climate. There is a lot of material out there for you to read about sex grooming gangs. There's a lot of things that you can find. Just Google Asian sex grooming gangs. You'll get like 14 million things popping up. Go to YouTube. There's videos there. Channel 4 did an expose on child sex grooming gangs. That's how a lot of these gangs were exposed. As you heard in that video that was mentioned. We have to stop it. And this always brings me back. How? How do we stop it? Listening to Lowell Green, I really liked what he had to say. Stop Islamic immigration, or at least put a moratorium, I don't know, 3 to 5 years on it. Personally, I would like to see a moratorium of 20 years. Let's deal with the Muslims that we have here already, and let's see how their kids grow up. Are they going to run off and become little jihadists? Or are they going to assimilate into North American and European society? Do not grant citizenship to anybody from an Islamic state. Shut down our embassies in Islamic countries that engage in jihad, whether that be kinetic or whether that be civilizational, like we are seeing with the Muslim Brotherhood. Dry up the resources. Stop feeding the beast. Dry them up. Break them. Stop the immigration. Do not grant citizenship. A few things we can do. I was reading an interesting story this week, and this comes out of Russia. Now, I put it on my blog, and I put a shout-out out because I need a little help with it because I'm not seeing a whole lot of information on it, so I don't want to delve too deeply, but from what I understand is that Russia wants to declare the Koran as extreme literature. Things like that we can do. But we have to go a lot further and stop the scourge facing us because it is just getting way too much. It's getting way out of hand. But you know what really annoys me? Is that we had these Koranimals all over the place. We saw what they did on the weekend. We saw what they did in Pakistan. We saw what they did in Kenya. Yeah. Torturing people. Not just killing Christians. They were killing them all right. They were killing them in the most abominable ways possible. What's our reaction? Oh, ban the burqa. That's the best we can do? Well, gee, you're slaughtering Christians and you're torturing them, so we're going to ban your burqa. Oh, is that really enough? And all we do is get them all riled up and they take to the streets with their placards and they scream racism, and I came to Canada because I was able to. I wanted freedom. I came here for freedom. I came to the United States because I wanted freedom. I have a right to wear my niqab. Well, we have a right to tell you to stop killing Christians and Jews and other minorities in Islamic states. There's another case here. This is a person named Emma. When Emma was 12, she was befriended by Muslim boys around her own age who soon introduced her to relatives in their 20s and 30s. Emma, she had no idea she was being groomed and brainwashed until one day, totally out of the blue, she was taken to a wasteland. I would assume that's a forest of sorts. And she was raped by the gang leader. This attack was watched by laughing gang members, and it was recorded on a number of cell phones. Emma said, people ask me, why I kept going back to Tariq, even after he raped me? Well, they threatened to firebomb my home and rape my own mother if I tried to escape. Emma's a young woman now who gives support through a charity set up to prevent the sexual abuse of children. She gives support to a number of victims of pimping gangs, and she has found that the girls are being targeted at even younger ages because the gangs want virgins and girls who are free of sexual disease. So most of the men buying sex with the girls have Muslim wives, and they don't want to risk infection. You see, that's right. The men buying the sex from these little girls, they have wives at home, and they don't want to infect their little Muslimas. The younger you look, the more saleable you are. Mm-mm. Asian grooming gangs going back as far as 2007, and who knows even further than that. And this brings me back to Anne Cryer. She's the former Labour MP for Cayley in Yorkshire, the one that was referred to in the video, the audio, that I played for you a few minutes back. Yeah. Trying to bring it to the attention that there is a real serious issue. Yeah. She was trying to tackle this problem. She was receiving requests for help from some of the parents of the children caught up with the gangs in her constituency. Now, according to some of the mothers, a fear of being branded racist makes many of the police and social services reluctant to investigate the crimes as organized and connected. Now, one mother from Rotherham, whose 14-year-old daughter was groomed into prostitution and multiply raped during a 12-month period, told the author that almost every man convicted of these crimes in the north of England is from Pakistan. However, the authorities insist that that is not relevant. Oh, well, why not? Why is that not relevant? Look, when you've got point A and it leads to point B, you have to connect those dots, okay? It's not relevant. Yes, it is relevant. These are immigrants from Pakistan entering our countries and raping our kids. It is relevant. It's called trend analysis, and we should be using it a little more often. I don't even care if it's profiling. I don't care about profiling. I want my kids safe. I do not want to open up my newspaper in the morning and find out that an 11-year-old girl had been groomed into a sex gang by some Pakistani national. Okay? So, yeah, it matters the world to me. Trend analysis. Come on. If it walks like a duck, if it talks like a duck, it must be a duck. Not relevant. Jeez. God. What are we going to, you know, there is a lot of support out there. I don't know if it's ad hoc support. It certainly seems like it to me. What about post hoc support? About teaching young girls the warning signs of what a sex grooming gang member is. We send our kids to school where they get to learn all about the wonders of Islam, how wonderful Islam is. They're forced to learn the five pillars of Islam. We have our little girls, our little Christian girls, donning the niqab to play Muslima for a day. How come in our schools we do not warn our daughters about the dangers of Islamic grooming gangs? Right, I got you. Yeah. Why not? We have to do it at home. Have you heard, though, there's a lot of cases out there when a parent sits down their child and says the truth, when they relate the realities of Islam, they're called upon by child protective service agencies. They're called upon to the mat. What are you doing? What are you doing in your own home with your own child? What are you teaching that child? Why is that child coming to school and saying that Islam, there's a few problems with it? Yeah. Islam, the protected status. There's a lot of things in here I could bring up, but I'm beating, you know, like I'm preaching to the choir here, right? Just preaching to the choir because you guys know all of this. I really don't need to tell you, but what I do need you to do, just take what you get from the blogs and the radio shows and share it. Share it further. I'm just a teacher here. I'm teaching you. You know what? I don't even need to do that. And plus, I'm not a very good teacher. But I am doing my best. I want my Canadian listeners to be aware, too. Guess what, Canada? Big, huge, old sex grooming gang uncovered. Yeah. You don't think it can happen here? Think again. It did. Victims as young as 11 years old. Man. Read some of these blogs. Wow. What's this one I read? I read this one too. This is from Stop Islamization of the World. Islamization of the World. Stop Islamization of the World. Yeah. What's the latest one we've got here? Oh, yeah. Oh, this comes, well, look at that. It comes out of Pakistan. This occurred 2 months ago. There was a young mother of two. She was stoned to death 2 months ago in Pakistan because she was in possession of a cell phone. Mm-hmm. Arifa Bibi. That was her name. Her uncle, her cousins, and others, they hurled stones and bricks at her until she died. She was buried in a desert far from her village, and it is unlikely anyone was arrested. Again with the honor killings, huh? In her crime? Because she had a cell phone. Why she had a cell phone? I don't know. How come she was not allowed to have a cell phone? I don't know. But she had a cell phone. For that, her punishment was death by stoning. Stoning has got to be the most cruel and hideous punishment. One of many. It's torture. You're torturing a person to death. If you want to see a dramatized version of what a stoning looks like, watch the movie The Stoning of Soria M. It's pretty damned graphic, and it's not far off the mark. Just watch that movie. I think you can actually get it on YouTube these days. I watched it from a website. I can't remember where, but I'm pretty sure. You know what? If you Google it, you'll find it because it is available for viewing, but just be warned. Watch it at night when the kids are in bed already, okay? Stoning a woman to death in Pakistan 2 months ago because she was in possession of a cell phone. I'll be. It's not just the stoning that's atrocious. We know about the gays being hanged from cranes for being gay. Remember the good old days when you went to a good old hanging? Usually a bad guy, like a bank robber or a murderer. Yeah. They were dropped through the trap door, instant death. Yeah. Well, That's not quite how they do it in Islam, isn't it? No. Your feet are firmly planted on the ground in a lot of cases. Not all cases, but a lot of cases. And you're hoisted up off the ground so that you strangle to death. Man, I have been underwater. I know what it's like to know not how to breathe. Imagine that being your ultimate. Strangling to death. Being strangled. I'd like to know where they get these rather creative methods of punishment. Technically, it's banned in a lot of Muslim countries. As a matter of fact, it's not legal in most Muslim countries. Well, that's reassuring. Stoning is not legal in most Muslim countries. And there's actually no mention of it in the Quran. So where do these brainstorms come from? Supporters of stoning say, though, that it is legitimized by the Hadith. And we know that as the acts and sayings of the false prophet Muhammad. We know that stoning is used for adultery. However, there are several interpretations of the Sharia, or Islamic law, and how it is to be carried out. We also know that a woman who has been raped is eligible to be stoned to death. We have cases as young, we have cases where the victims are as young as 13 years old in recent memory. There was one little girl, her name was Shamim. She was 13 years old from Somalia. She was buried up to her neck and stoned by 50 men in front of 1,000 people at a stadium in 2008. It is recent memory, so. Her father told Amnesty International she had been raped by 3 men, but she was accused of adultery when she tried to report the rape to the Al-Shabaab militia in control of the city. Well, that was a bit of a mistake. I don't know why this poor little 13-year-old Somali girl would think Al-Shabaab would protect her. Totally mind-baffling. Well, I'm at the top of the hour, and Mike will be Skyping in. I'm going to give him a chance to do that. I'm going to take a little bit of a break. But I thought, why not play something out of Australia? So I was looking for a song. And I thought, well, I'm just going to go with a standard. I came across Beds Are Burning by Midnight Oil. So I'm going to play that. However, I'm taking liberties with the meaning of the lyrics of the song. Now, it's pretty much understood that the lyrics by Midnight Oil were to protest the mistreatment of Aboriginals in Australia. But when you listen to the lyrics, kind of twist them a bit, put a little bit of a different meaning behind them, and think of Islamic infiltration. I'll see you back here in a few minutes.
The time has come
Remind you again, Mike Holt is the CEO of Restore Australia, and that is the official website of the Foundation for a National Renewal, which was created because Australia, Mike Holt, Restore Australia, they had to find a way to return the power to the people. They have to be a voice in the direction that the great nation Australia takes. And Mike Holt is also highly He's also a highly successful campaigner to bring awareness of Islamic issues that affect Australia. I mentioned his most notable campaign was his sticker campaign to apprise the public about unknowingly purchasing halal products. And with that, Mike is right here, and I'm going to bring him on with me right now. And Mike, hello, and welcome to the Red Fox Blogger. How are you today?
Good morning from down under.
Good morning. 6 a.m. your time.
Yes, it is. Coffee injection done.
Oh, we had a little bit of confusion there. No, I know. When I'm in the studio, unfortunately, I don't have Skype access when I'm in the studio.
All right.
There you go. But that's okay. We've got you here, and it is an honor, sir, that you are joining me today on my program. I was rather intrigued by you. A few months back, I was at a blog, and that was Bare Naked Islam, and she was posting about an Australian politician who was facing threats from the Islamic so-called community because you dare to speak out about the issues of Islam. And I thought, well, that's rather interesting. So I thought, I really want to get a hold of this gentleman. I'm so glad I did. But I was explaining to my listeners about Restore Australia. How did that all come about? What made you compelled that you felt that you had to do something? You are the CEO of Restore Australia. What exactly is that, and what exactly does that entail, and how useful is that to the people of Australia?
All right, thank you. First of all, I'd like to say what a pleasure it is to be here. Thank you for calling me.
Oh, absolutely.
How did it all get started? Well, I lived over in Thailand for 30 years, and I also went to high school in Penang in Malaysia. So I've lived amongst the Muslims for a long, long time. Thailand is a Buddhist country, of course, but there are plenty of Muslims there. And down in southern Thailand, they actually have an insurgency going on down there with the Muslims trying to secede from Thailand. And so I've seen what Islam is. Up dirty, close and dirty, and it's a very scary thing. And also, having lived in Thailand for so many years, as a foreigner up there, I was always a stranger in a strange land. I had no political power, I couldn't vote. So when I sold my businesses and returned to Australia, I thought I was going back to a civilized country with a decent government system. And I wasn't here very long. Sorry?
Oh, no. Go ahead.
Okay. So I wasn't here very long. And Julia Gillard stabbed, what's his name? Just forgotten. The sitting prime minister in the back, and we had a coup. Now, I recognize a coup because in Thailand, I lived through five of them. Kevin Rudd is his name. And so I looked at the situation and I realized that we have no real democracy in Australia. We can choose between one party or the other, but we just can't do, we can't influence how the government works. So I looked around to see what was possible, and I was lucky enough to run into a chap called Lieutenant Colonel Charles Mollison. Now, he was a Vietnam War veteran and a hero of the Battle of Long Tan. And I met him and gave me a copy of a draft constitution that he's been writing for the last 15 years. And about 100 people behind him. And I read this thing and I thought, this is what Australia needs. We need to change our constitution and bring it into line with modern reality. So that's basically how I got started. And I said to him, would he mind if I started up a group called Restore Australia and we start promoting this? And he gave me the go-ahead, and that's what I've been doing since. Sorry, you're breaking up a little bit there.
Oh, I'm there.
Sorry, say that again.
Andre, what kind of reception are you receiving for the Restore Australia movement in Australia?
Oh, very good. People are coming to our Facebook page every day, and that's Facebook.com/MikePolt. And hang on a moment, I'll give you the exact address. MikePolt RA. So it's one word, MikePolt, H-O-L-T-R-A.
Wonderful.
And people are welcome to join me there as a friend, no problem. But the response has been very, very good. And I have people all over Australia who support what we're doing. And it's not just me. I mean, everybody is on board with the idea. We want to amend the constitutions so that we can put the power in the hands of the people to start referendums. I'll give you a little bit of background on this. The founding fathers, when they wrote our original constitution that was ratified in 1901 by a referendum of all the states, they did a marvellous job for the time. And this is back in the horse and buggy days, so we didn't have very fast communications. We certainly didn't have all the advantages that we have today. And they made one basic mistake when they wrote the constitution. They put the power into the hands of the politicians to initiate referendum. Now, the only people who can change the constitution are the people voting in referendum. But we just don't have the power to start a referendum. So that's the problem. Now, I've been working for the last 3 years to try and bring that about. It's a very difficult challenge because the politicians, of course, don't want the power in the hands of people, because that would limit their ability to do whatever they like. And I've actually been told by one politician here that's exactly how they feel. And I have a quote from him. He said, "The parties will never support citizens-initiated referendums because when they get to Parliament, they would not be able to do whatever they wish." And that just sums up exactly where we are in Australia at the moment.
Mike, welcome back, and my deepest apologies.
Oh, it's not your fault. It's just the communication with you.
Oh, everything. My entire studio went on me. I don't know what happened. I was trying to use my phone. Nothing was happening there. I think it was my end. I think it was my internet that went on me. But we got you back, and I'm so happy. But, yes, we were discussing Restore Australia. I put the link in the chat room for people to take a look at. I also put it in the show highlights for my archive listeners to catch up on later.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading the website, and the two goals that you have is, one, to give Australians a greater control of their constitution, and we went through that. And number two, to get all Australian voters involved in writing a whole new constitution.
Right.
Do you think that would be feasible, actually rewriting the entire constitution?
Well, you know what they say, once something is broken, you can't fix it. And our current constitution was designed to unite 6 British colonies into one British colony. And it did that job very, very well. But in 112 years since then, we have developed as a proud and strong nation, and our constitution has not kept up to date. We've had 44 referendums, but only 8 have passed. And the reason for this is that the politicians control who can start a referendum, and they are not doing their job. So that's why, first of all, we want to put the control back into the hands of the people to initiate referendums. And then the second thing, it will be up to the people to decide whether they want to amend the whole constitution or amend bits of it. But the draft constitution that we've written proposes a completely new system. And I think it's a much, much better system. It's based on common sense ideas, which is something we don't get in politics here.
One thing I do not know if you have in Australia, but in Canada we certainly do, and that is official multiculturalism.
Oh, yes, we have that here too.
It is official.
Yes.
I think multiculturalism has probably been the biggest exercise in failure in terms of social experimenting.
Well, we believe the same. No, it's not working. You see, there's a difference between the people who are coming here today and the immigrants that came here, or have come here ever since Captain Cook arrived. The people who are coming here today come from a very different cultural background. All the previous immigrants came from Europe or America or other countries where the Commonwealth and Western civilization was the common factor. But these people coming today from the Middle East and Northern India, places like that, they come from a totally different culture, and they don't understand what we stand for, and therefore they're not trying to integrate. Now, I don't have any problem with multicultures coming to Australia. But those cultures must understand that they're coming to our nation, and they must integrate into our ideas and our culture. And if they're not doing that, we're going to have a problem.
One thing I find in particular, when official multiculturalism, for example, when it was introduced into Canada in the early 80s, it seemed like it could have been a rather brilliant embracement of various cultures, but then one particular culture came along, and we know that culture as Islam, and it's pretty much ruined it all. One thing that bothers me under official multiculturalism is that we have to respect that all cultures are equal, and we know that, Mike, that that is not a fact. All cultures are not equal, and in particular, Islamic culture is not compatible with Western culture, with their Sharia, for example.
Yes, exactly. And that's the problem. Now, you know, as I said, we have no trouble with people coming here to Australia to live among us. We welcome. But not when they try and force their ideas and their culture on us.
Exactly. And that is what they're doing. Where we're seeing this more and more in Canada, you're seeing it in Australia, the United States. Well, they're seeing it. Certainly Europe is seeing it. I mean, England is under siege. I was speaking with a gentleman out of England, and he swears that if things don't drastically change for the better in terms of the Islamic encroachment there, it could very well break out into a civil war.
I'm hearing the same message here. I'm in touch with quite a lot of Brits, especially through the PL and also through UKIP. The United Kingdom Independence Party, led by what's his name? Yeah, my memory's bad this morning. Anyway.
Oh, the UKIP party.
Sorry.
The UKIP party.
Yes.
The leader of the UKIP party.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Nigel Farage.
Yes, Nigel. Yeah, Nigel Farage.
Yeah.
That's right. The UK Independence Party. Yeah.
But those people are fighting against this Islamization, and of course I'm in touch with them,
Yes.
I'm also in touch with people in Canada and America, New Zealand, South Africa. Most people are not aware of what is going on in South Africa. Now, all the white farmers there are slowly but surely being decimated. They're being killed. And
yeah.
When I say killed, whole families are being killed. And we are getting quite a few of them coming to Australia. They're very good immigrants because they're educated, they're hardworking, they want to fit in, and yet the Australian government is making it almost impossible for them to come here. And the people who do come here face many, many problems. And yet these people sail in on boats from the Middle East, and they just sail right in and take all our tax money for benefits and housing, free telephones, free this, free that. And our pensioners and our disabled, our homeless, we have no money to look after them.
And they breed like rabbits. It's part of my vernacular, but they come here and they do take advantage of the social services, are very generous social services, and they have large families. And family reunification, they bring over the parents and they bring over the aunts, which we know as to be maybe the second wife. They have four wives and all these women are having kids.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there are families here. You know, four families living on the dole, and they make far more money than I do.
See, a lot of people wonder, how can a cab driver and his wife have, maybe they have, I don't know, four kids. A cab driver and a wife has four kids, but he's living in a fairly decent neighborhood, for example. How does he afford that? Well, it's because he has three other wives probably on the dole.
That's right. Same here.
Yeah.
But,
and they're all
to get back to the
same
UK,
way.
To get back to the UK, they have the same problem. Now, I've been talking to these people, and they are getting so frustrated that they're talking openly now about civil war. And I can't see any other solution, to be honest with you, because the political parties there have a stranglehold on Parliament. And unless UKIP can get in and start making the changes that are necessary, I can't see any other alternative to civil war. It's terrible that we've been reduced to this.
It's mind-boggling in that it seems that like within one generation or even within less than one generation that the Western world has pretty much been turned on its heel due to the influx of Islamic immigration. And it's Islamic immigration in particular that is the true threat. Islam is a real threat. And Islam, it is beholden to nobody but the Quran and the Sharia law. And they don't care what we think. They don't care about our man-made laws. They don't care about our constitution. They don't care about our wanting them to assimilate into the host culture. They simply will not, because they feel it is their right to spread the caliphate. They are on a mission. And I got a really good... go ahead. Go ahead, Mike.
That's right. And I keep telling people that Islam many times has declared war on us. In the last 10 years, many imams have said outright, we are at war with the West, and we will conquer the West. And they're doing this in many different ways. So we have to understand that we are at war. Now, I never agreed much with George Bush, but I did agree that we are at war with Islam. And we have been at war, to be honest with you, for 1,400 years. It just was waxing flames. I mean, you know, if you look back at history, the gates of Vienna, we almost lost Europe. Barbary pirates. Again, if it hadn't been for the Americans going in there and exorcising those pirates, we would have been the Muslims would have been rampaging across Europe and we would have been in deep trouble. So we are at war. I have to understand that.
God bless Thomas Jefferson and the Marines.
Yep.
For going after the Barbary pirates when he did. And
yes,
you're right about the gates of Vienna. The gates of Vienna was something else. That 1529. It took place in the Siege of Vienna in 1529, and that was the first attempt by the Ottoman Empire, and that was led by Suleiman the Magnificent. When they were defeated, that was on September 11th. People don't understand the history of 9/11 and why September 11th is such an important date to the Muslims, the Islamists. And that, of course, is it ties right back to the Siege of Vienna. And you're right. We have been battling. We have been battling these Muslims for 1,400 years, and it's I don't see an end in sight in my lifetime, Mike. What about you?
Well, we have to. I always tell people that we have some advantages over them. For a start, they have a very poor society. They don't have our intelligence because they don't have the education that we have. They don't have the weaponry that we have, although we've given them too much already. But at the end of the day, we are much smarter than them, and we can beat them with intelligence. But we're going to have to understand, first of all, that we are at war with them. And then we have to take the steps. Now, the problem that we face is that our leaders cannot see this. They're too blind, and they're only concerned with perpetuating their own power. We need leaders who are decisive and willing to step up and say, we are going to stop you, and this is how we're going to do it. Now, in Australia, I am advocating, first and foremost, that we change our constitution to put the power into the hands of the people, so that we, the people, can make the decision. But more importantly, I'm going to propose, as we have proposed in the draft constitution, that we bring in national service. Now, with national service, we would have a well-armed citizenry able to defend our nation, and we would not go to war overseas unless the people vote in a referendum for it, unless we're directly threatened, of course. Now, the problem is we are directly threatened from within. But nobody here in Australia or anywhere else is willing to take that decision to understand that we are threatened, that we need to fight now. And Australia, we're very lucky because we can see what's going on over in the UK and the EU, and in perhaps to a smaller extent to Canada and America. We can see what's going on, and we have the time now to do something about it. But we don't have the leadership. That's the problem.
And I also don't think we have the numbers, the number of bodies that we need, because one thing that I constantly run into, too, is not only our politicians, per se, that actually are in a position of power to actually change things, but it's the populace. And you run into the apologists, and you run into those who are actually quite ignorant about the ramifications of what Islam means once it gets a foothold, once the population percentages start to grow. Like, we've got that smiling Muslim right now. You know, he's a great coworker, he's a great neighbor, but don't trust a smiling Muslim. Do not trust Muslims. I do not believe in moderate Muslims. I don't believe they exist. I believe that they are laying low. And if the numbers grow, that smiling neighbor is going to be the first one stabbing you in the back.
Oh yeah, and they've been doing this already.
Yep.
They're doing this already. They are turning on their neighbors, and they are killing their neighbors. Uh-huh. And this happens all the time. But people just want to stick their head in the ground and say, well, you know, they are nice people. They live next door to me. I've been working with them for years. But they forget one very important thing. Islam is Islam. And the radicals, jihadists, believe in exactly the same Islam as the moderates do. And all it takes is for a jihadist imam to come to the moderate and say, you have to go and kill that Christian neighbor. And they will do it. That's it.
There was a case not too long ago, I believe it was in Syria, that there were a Christian family and a Muslim family. They were living side by each for years. They were very good neighbors. And all of a sudden, they were given, the Muslim family, They were given their marching orders to slaughter that Christian family, and they balked at first. They said, no, I can't kill these people. They've been my neighbors for years. They're very nice people. Well, it's either you do it or we kill your family. So what did they do? They went over and they slaughtered the Christian family because they were told to.
That's right. That's what happened. So you're right. We cannot trust the Muslims amongst us. It's what we called in the Second World War the fifth column. If we
Absolutely.
Don't understand that, we will die. That's it.
And I have Luchadora in my chat room. She brought up a really good point, and this ties into it, is that the problem with Muslim immigration is that they pretend to assimilate. They pretend, and that's what it brings us back, right back to the smiling Muslim. How do you trust a Muslim? I'm sorry, but I've been doing this radio show for over a year, and one thing that in my studies and the things that I'm exposed to in doing it is that I'm coming across too much of the contrary to convince me that moderation exists in Islam. That's like saying I'm a moderate Christian. I'm not a Christian. I follow the book of the Bible. I follow Jesus Christ is my Lord and Savior. I'm no more a moderate Christian than this person over there is a moderate Muslim. It does not exist. You either believe or you don't. You're either in or you're out. And that smiling Muslim, they're lying to us. They're lying. They're engaging in that taqiyya, and they're trying to convince us that, no, we're a peaceful religion. We're very good people. When, in fact, we know they're not. When we witnessed what happened in Kenya there, Mike, last weekend, separating the Christians from the Muslims, telling the Muslims to leave and killing the Christians. They didn't want the Muslims. They wanted the Christians. Is that moderate Islam? No, it's not. That is Islam. That is what Islam is. Pure and simple.
Exactly.
You're a very busy man. I don't know where you find time to sleep because you've got you're involved in so many things. You also have a very active YouTube channel, and you post your videos are brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And I put the link for your YouTube channel in my show highlights. So, ladies and gentlemen, just scroll above, and the link is right there for Mike Holt's YouTube channel. Check out some of the videos in there. They're fantastic. You have that going on. You have Restore Australia going on. You have the Facebook pages going on. And you have One Nation, the voice of the people, going on.
It's not as hard as you might think. I mean, it all sounds like a lot. The video channel... I filmed most of those videos during the election campaign when I ran for the seat here in my area for One Nation. But that took me a couple of days to film the whole thing. The video of me on the beach in Surfers Paradise was made last year by a very good supporter, Aussie Beach TV. They've made some brilliant videos. And yesterday I had a film crew here at my house, and we filmed a segment for a documentary that they're filming on halal food.
Really?
Took me about an hour and a half to film that. So, I mean, all this stuff is going on, but it doesn't keep me 100% employed. And in fact, talking of employment... Mm-hmm. After the election, I now have to go out and do some work. I've actually got to make some money. But I was very lucky because I funded my election campaign by selling the anti-halal stickers. And the response was fantastic. Now, it might not have been so good if one of my supporters hadn't got arrested for ostensibly, allegedly putting a sticker on a jar of coffee. And What happened there was a Muslim woman bought the jar of coffee, took it home, opened the lid, but didn't actually open the contents. You know, she didn't break the seal. So after she opened the lid, she saw the sticker on the back of the jar of coffee. So she went back to the supermarket, and the next thing I know, well, I didn't know, but I got a visit from three big burly Australian Federal Police saying we want to see, and they brought a court order, And I had to show them all the names of the people who had bought the stickers. And they decided that this young lady, because she lived closest to the supermarket, was the culprit. That's all the proof they had. And as I pointed out to them, you know, later on, I said, look, I travel all over the place and stick these stickers everywhere. It could have been anybody. Now, the young lady denies vehemently that she put that sticker on, and I believe her. So anybody could have done it. And so now they're dragging her into court every month and trying to wear her down and get her to admit that she did it. And, of course, she's standing firm. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens, because they, honestly, they don't have a case. They charged her with food tampering. The Queensland Department of Health checked the jar of coffee and declared that there was no tampering with the product. It was intact. So I don't know where their charge is going to come from. Their case. They have no case. But, you know, that's up to the courts to decide. So, yeah. But what I was going to say, that case brought the whole thing to the forefront right around Australia with fantastic publicity. And as a result, I was able to sell a lot of stickers, and that funded my election campaign. Now, I'm still selling the stickers, and the money that I'm getting now, I'm banking. And when I have enough, I will be buying bus advertising in Sydney and Melbourne to let people know that we are being charged an illegal Islamic tax on our food.
That's something that really bothers me, Mike, is the halal issue. Now, I understand, I know New Zealand and Australia as well, that a lot of the abattoirs are halal run. It's virtually impossible to purchase protein products that are not halal blessed.
Yes, that's true.
And that bothers me. That bothers me a great deal. Well, another thing that bothers me in terms of halal, I mean, of course, just the manner in which the animals are rendered. I mean, that's horrific enough. But it's pretty much, in Canada in particular, it's up to the proprietor to let us know whether or not we are actually purchasing halal products. That bothers me. I want to know what I'm purchasing. I have a right to know if I am buying halal meat products. I have a right to know, because I refuse to consume halal products. It's to the point where I am going to be virtually eating out of my garden in the backyard exclusively.
So what can we do about it? Well, first of all, I don't want my product labeled halal. I don't want them as halal at all. I want to stop halal. You have to understand the scope and extent of this scam, and it is a scam. Last year, halal food certification got $2 trillion income for the Muslims. That's $2 trillion. Now, what happens to that money? A lot of it goes into the pockets of the halal certification company owners. And there's usually only one guy who owns it, and he pockets a lot of that money. One of them boasted he made $50,000 profit last year and bought his wife a lot of shoes. Well, whoop-de-doo. I don't want to pay for my shoes for a start, but they are lying about the income. And, of course, we can't find out how much they are really making. But the guy who was filming the documentary yesterday told me his father is a beef cattle farmer, and he now goes to the abattoir where they do not do halal slaughter, and he makes sure that his cattle are slaughtered properly. But these people, these Muslims, are making this money out of our halal food. And a portion of that money goes to what they call Muslim charities. Well, Muslim charities like Hamas, the Muslim Brotherhood, and a whole bunch of other ones, we have proof beyond a doubt that they fund terrorism, that they are associated with terrorists, or that they are terrorists. So every time we go to the supermarket and buy something that is halal certified, we are funding terrorism, and that's what my sister says.
This is what I tell my listeners. I say every time you walk into an Islamic-owned business, you're paying a, well, you're an infidel, so you're paying a some sort of jizya, but you're also enabling that proprietor to pay a zakat, and that goes to support terrorism. We know that. That is some sort of contribution to Islam, but we know where the zakat money is going. It's going to, it's not going to fund charities, and they can blow the sunshine all they want there, Mike, but we know what the zakat is going towards. It's going towards the further the caliphate, whether that be by sword or by word, whatever. It's still a contribution towards their global caliphate.
Well, what you have to understand is that a portion of that money that's funding terrorism is spent on buying the weaponry to kill our troops. Now, I believe the Canadian troops are in Afghanistan too. And so the next troop, the next soldier that is killed is going to be killed by a bullet that was funded by somebody who bought a bar of Cadbury's chocolate, or somebody who bought a jar of Vegemite. Somebody who bought one of the products that are halal certified. We are paying to kill our own troops. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Now, I'll just give you an idea.
Go ahead.
We have a website over here called halalchoices.com.au. And the lady who runs this is running very, very scared because the Muslims keep threatening her, death threats. But she has compiled a booklet which lists all the products that are halal certified. Now, it's a huge long list. In fact, if you walk through the supermarket these days, it's almost impossible to find something that is not halal certified.
Exactly.
But big brand names, all run by Kraft Foods. Kraft Foods is a big dinny company. They are paying this halal certification fee. Hundreds of thousands of dollars. We don't know exactly how much, but you can bet it's a big amount of money. Cadbury's chocolate.
Well, I'll tell you, I was rather disappointed when I found out one of my favorite lines was halal certified, and that was Campbell's soup and Campbell's products. I was very disappointed that I had to stop buying the product because I really did enjoy the soup. But that's what I mean. I'm getting pushed further and further and further into my own garden patch. And Vito Esposito, he brought up a really good point in the chat room, and he was talking about the rendering plants, and one in particular was Tyson Foods and other packaging plants that are run by Somalis. And a lot of these places are getting shut down because of the lack of hygiene as well. There was a case in Shelbyville, Tennessee, where one plant was shut down due to tuberculosis. We have issues with the Muslimas who will not use the boot washes. Their skirts are dragging all over the floor. They're infecting everything. They're causing all sorts of diseases. I mean, for goodness sake, tuberculosis, it's 2001.
Yeah.
Or 2011, I'm sorry. It's 2011, or where am I? Hello, Cal. Time to get my calendar. I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, I implore you. I'm sorry when my audio went through me. But it's 2013, and we're still dealing with these feudal diseases. And this is what another thing, another gift from Islam that keeps on giving.
Yeah. Now, we've got to put a stop to it. As I said before, I don't want my food labeled halal. I want it stopped. There is only one thing to do, because first of all, we are funding terrorism. And secondly, why are we paying an illegal religious tax on our food? Nobody asked us. They just did it. And these stupid companies went ahead and paid it. And they are being duplicitous. They are not telling us the truth. And as a result, we're paying through the nose. Now, we're paying on an average 20 cents a kilo more to cover the cost of halal certification. 20 cents out of a kilo. Think about that.
Exactly. That's the thing that I find very, very frustrating, is that they're allowed to get away with it. I don't understand exactly how we allow our politicians to allow it to happen, because it is going on. I do not understand why people are not apprised to what Islam is. There are so many examples out there. I think it's not all the politicians, they want the vote. And that sickens me in itself. But it's the general population, and I always leave this question with my listeners and with people with whom I speak. How do you convince that person who says that, well, Islam's not too bad? What is it going to take until they realize that, yes, Islam really is that bad? Is it going to take a bomb going off underneath their house or one of their loved ones to be affected by the ramifications of Islam?
Look, I'm expecting that to happen any day in Australia. We're just about to have our grand final. That would be a perfect place for them to blow up. I mean, there's about 150,000 people attend that. Imagine the carnage if they did. Now, if you go over to my website, under the main menu, Get Involved, you'll see a menu there, Resist Islamization. And what I've done there, I have written some letters that we can send to our representatives, sample letters. So I've got halal letters, another halal letter, ban Islam letter. We need to keep bombarding our representatives with these letters and telling them we do not want Islam, we do not want halal, please stop it. And in Australia, I'm not sure about Canada, but if we put the word "it is my will" in capital letters that you do something, the politician must listen to you and respond, because that is a legal requirement. So if you put "it is my will" all in caps, the politician will respond. And we usually they'll just say, "Oh, here's a form letter. Thank you, we got it. We were investigating," but they don't do anything. So it's up to we, the people. We have to keep on bombarding them with these letters. We have to keep telling them we want it stopped. That's simple.
Absolutely. And I couldn't agree with that one any more than, you know. We have to call the Muslims out. We have to call them out, and we have to stop allowing them airtime to spout nonsense that Islam is a religion of peace, and for us to say otherwise is that we are labeled as racist or Islamophobes. I brought that up at the beginning of the program. We have to call them in their tracks and say, why am I a racist? What is it about Islam that makes it a race, for one, which it's not? I mean, we have the gingerheads running around over there in England. Yeah. Why is it when I critique Islam, I am labeled a racist? And this is institutionalized. They are trying to institutionalize into racism labels. Why is that, and how do we stop that, Mike?
Well, we have to tell them exactly each time. We have to call them on that charge, and we have to ask them, what is racist about a religion? If I criticize Christianity, am I racist? So you have to make them start to think. You see, these people, the Muslims have come up with this idea, and they've convinced all the lefties and the commies and all these socialists that being against Islam is racist. But you have to ask yourself, where do Muslims come from? They come from all over the world. How can you be racist against the whole world? It's ridiculous.
Oh, absolutely. You cannot. Absolutely, you cannot. And I just want to let my listeners know that we are down to 5 minutes of the live portion of the program. I'm going to run into a little bit of archive. So if you want to catch the rest of the interview with Mike Holt and myself, please come back and check out the archive later on when it is up for archive listen. Before I do that, though, I do want to acknowledge the people that visited my show today. I want to thank Ann Vanderlees. I want to thank Vork. I want to thank my guests, one of them being Mike Holt. I want to thank Lucha Dora, Moving Forward, Vito Esposito, Mama Mia, No Sharia. I want to thank Zook. I want to thank people who popped in, who popped out. I want to thank Sue from New Mexico, my sweetheart, who is listening on the line and is keeping me company in the studio. You guys are fantastic. You are the absolute best. If it weren't for you, there would be no me. I would not be able to do this show. Please remember, Islam is a true threat. It's mass Islamity. We have to stop the insanity. Please spread this show. Spread all the other shows. Spread all the shows from Radio Jihad Network. Listen to Vito Esposito tonight, in fact, at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. The Vito Esposito Show at Radio Jihad Network, right here on Blog Talk Radio. Listen to all of them throughout the week. 7 shows, 7 days a week. Radio Jihad Network. Be there. Ladies and gentlemen, in case you catch me in mid-sentence, I'll just say it right now. Thank you all very much for being here. Have a wonderful evening, and I will, of course, see you back here in my other time slot on Friday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and who knows what tomfoolery this infidel will be up to then. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very, very much. And there we go, Mike. And we are just about done the live portion of the show, and we are going to go into the archive portion. But I feel really bad because I had such an issue with my audio that I really wanted to afford you a good hour. You were gracious enough to take that time out of your schedule to spend with me. So
well,
I'm not
going
to keep you for 2 hours. I would like to.
No problem. Look, if you want to call me again sometime, let me know and we can organize it. And I'd just like to say that we have a lot of information on our website, restoreaustralia.org.au. I've got, you can buy the anti-halal stickers, the ban Islam stickers. We've got halal decor for sale. We also have many pages of information how Islamization works. We have an Islamic flyer that people can print out and hand out. We have articles on opposing mosques and madrasas. We also have an Islamic constitution for Australia on this. This is Al-Shabaab or something. They have issued a whole new constitution, an Islamic constitution. Who the hell do they think they are? I post a lot of information quite regularly on the website under recent posts on the right-hand side. I've just posted one today, Obama, Islam versus Christianity, comparing his statements on Islam to the statements on Christianity. Read that, it's scary stuff. One other point, a lot of people are coming to me and saying, oh, our government is run by a corporation registered in America. Well, we can stop the government using OPPT. Don't believe this rubbish. It's not true. I know one guy here just tried using OPPT and they locked him up in a loony bin. So You can't fight the government this way. We must get back to the basics, and that is our constitution. Not sure about in Australia, in America or Canada, but America has a very strong constitution, but it's been hijacked by the oligarchs. We need to stop them. And that's only by getting the people. Just one more point. On September 11, the Muslims announced they were going to have a million Muslim march on Washington. I think 12 people turned up. But 800,000.
Oh, yeah. They called it the 98.5. Absolutely love that. As opposed to the million
Americans
that showed up.
Well done, America. Love you for that. Thank you.
Done.
Patriotism
and
is not there.
Good night. Good night, my live listeners. Please catch the rest in archives. There we go. Now we are into the archival portion of the program, Mike. But yes, that was brilliant what the bikers did. They were not issued a permit to do that. They certainly got around it. And one thing that people didn't know until after the rally is that because they didn't have a permit, they would have been forced to stop at every stoplight, right? Well,
yeah.
police officers were unofficially escorting them right through the stoplights, and people were on the sidewalks and they were cheering. It was wonderful. That is the sort of solidarity that we need. That is the sort of action that we need to see. I've always been one. Yes, I've always been a little wary of a kinetic protest. I've always been a little wary about getting out there. But now when I see what's going on, I see what the English Defense League does. I see what the Million Bikers did in Washington, what they did. And it really does make a difference. And it does let the Muslims know that we're not going to hide behind our keyboards and complain, and we're not going to hide behind our the skirts of our Jimmy Mamas and Papas. We're going to get out there, and we're going to let you Muslims know that we're fed up and we're not taking it anymore. Either you ship up or you get out. Get out. Just leave. As a matter of fact, it's interesting. We had an imam here in Calgary, in Canada, and he was saying to his brethren, I guess, if, you know, for lack of a better term, he was telling them, Muslims, go home. Like, go back to your country. Why do you want to be in the West? Why do you want to be here when the laws and the norms and the culture is so foreign to what you want? Don't come here. Go back home. This is what we're telling them too.
Then you see, the problem is they come here. I don't know about over there, but here in Australia, our previous government gave them all the benefits. They gave them dole money, they gave them housing, they gave them free phones, and that's why they come here.
Absolutely. The freebies are fantastic.
Yeah, same thing in the UK.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and they're proud of it, too. It's funny, there's that one character out of London, Ajim Chowdhury, talking about that. When they're collecting the benefits, they're actually collecting their, it's called a jizya. He calls it the jizya benefits or something like that.
Yeah.
Where he says, oh, you know, we're just collecting our jizya.
Yeah.
They owe us. And that's how they treat it. They treat it like, well, you owe us something. And we're, you know, you're paying the jizya tax for us via our welfare benefits.
We owe them exactly what they have been giving us. Yeah, that's it. I know that sounds very rough, but they are killing us. They are killing Christians around the world. They are blowing innocent people up. Well, now the worm is turning, and I think we outnumber them, and we have far more intelligence than them. And when we get going, we will make sure that they are finished.
Absolutely. I think we are at a critical mass in history right now. I was interviewing an author last Friday, and that was Paul Sutcliffe, and he wrote a fantastic book called Stealth Jihad Phase 2. And he was actually talking about the Council of American Islamic Relations, the Muslim Student Association in the American college campuses. And he was asked, well, why did you title it Phase 2, Stealth Jihad Phase 2? And he said, well, because they've reached phase one. They've come in and they're establishing their civilization jihad. They've reached phase one. Now they're in phase two, and that is to infiltrate the colleges and start the conversion process.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree with that more.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And that is exactly it.
We need to beat them with education. We need to beat them by telling our children what is going on. Now, my daughter is 13 years old, and she is a very strong atheist. She doesn't believe in any God because she thinks for herself. Now, I have no problem with Christians believing whatever they want, because they don't go out blowing people up. They don't try and force their ideas on other people. But the Muslims, I have a very big problem with them, because they are trying to change our ways, and I won't stand for it. Nor will my daughter.
Absolutely, and that's the thing. We have a legacy to protect, and we have our progeny to protect. I always say this, like, if I don't do something, my children will never forgive me. My grandchildren certainly will.
Yeah.
I have no problem with anybody's faith, whether they be atheist or whether they worship the giant spaghetti monster. I don't care. As long as you're not blowing me up or my family up or my buildings up or my institutions up, and you're trying to usurp what we have here in the West, whether it be with your Sharia or whether it be with your violent kinetic jihad. If you're going to do that, I'm going to fight back. All of us will fight back. That's what we're here for. That's what we're going to do. And, Mike, that's why I think we're at such a critical juncture in history right now. I think things are going to come to a head. I think we're going to see some very dramatic changes within our lifetime. Whether we see a resolution, I don't know. But I'm quite certain we're going to see dramatic changes within the next few years at the very least.
Well, I think that we don't have to wait for a few years. It's happening right now. And if we go by the number of comments on my Facebook page, a lot of people are getting very frustrated, and we are uniting. Now, one of the things that I have sorted out is a unity congress, and I'm organizing these congresses all across Australia, and the first step is for them to sit down and consider the draft constitution and come up with suggested amendments and changes so that we end up with a truly Australian constitution, one written by the people for the people. And this will also help to unify all these disparate groups. We have minor parties, we have special interest groups, we have interested people, all of them coming together to work on this draft constitution and discuss our concerns at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping over the next 12 months we're going to be running these. And by the time we're finished, I hope to have unified all these disparate groups into one solid group that we can confront the government and say, we want these changes.
That's and we do. Absolutely.
If we don't
Mike,
do that,
it has been so enlightening, like in meeting you. I was saying to my listeners that I was at one of my favorite blog sites, and that's Bare Naked Islam, and that's Bonnie. And actually, Bonnie was on my show a couple of weeks ago, and she's an absolute delight, and she would love to come back. But I was visiting her website, and I came across this person named Mike Holt, who was being threatened by Islamists for his campaign. I thought, well, who is this person? I really do have to meet this man. I'm so glad I did, Mike, because your pages are a wealth of information. The campaign that you're engaged in is inspiring. We need more of you globally. And please, can you emigrate to Canada? Just kidding. I know you won't. But believe me, we need more politicians like you. We need more politicians in the federal arena standing up and saying, look, this is what's going on. This is what is wrong. I am so glad that I have met you. I'm so glad that we're friends on Facebook as well. It's an absolute pleasure to know you, sir.
Thank you. And, I'm not doing anything unusual. I'm just standing up for what is right and common sense. That's all it is. And that, unfortunately, we don't have too many people in our political sphere that stand for that.
Absolutely.
That's the problem.
Will you come back to the program again soon?
Sure, I'll be very happy to.
And I promise we won't have audio glitches. That has only, it's funny. I've been doing this show for over a year, and that this is only the second time that the audio has totally failed on me. So I'm a little embarrassed by that. But, yeah, it's live radio. These things happen.
I do indeed.
Mike, it has been an absolute pleasure. I want to thank you so very much, and I'm going to let you get back to your coffee. It's, boy, oh boy, 7 a.m. your time.
Yeah.
Mike, thank you. It was an honor. Have
Absolutely.
A great day, and I'll be talking with you soon.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank
Bye,
you, Mike.
Canada.
And ladies and gentlemen, that was my guest, Mike Holt of Restore Australia. Please pay attention to what he has to say. This is a global battle. We are in this. We are in it, and we have to be in it. We cannot have one foot in, and we cannot have one foot out. We have to commit to the fact that there is an issue. That issue is Islam. We have to confront it, and we have to back it down. You know, it's like playing whack-a-mole. I know. You whack one down and two more pop up. But you know what? As a collective, as a people, as a voice standing up, for our democracies and our constitutional values, even if we have to change a few things here and there to achieve what we want, and that is to defeat the intended global caliphate of Islam. We have to do it for our children. We have to do it for our grandchildren. We have a legacy we have to protect. We have a future we have to protect. Let's all do it together. We are all in this together. I want to thank you very much for joining me today. I am more than happy to have brought you this program. I will see you again on Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Ladies and gentlemen, mass is calamity. Stop the insanity. Good afternoon.